Call the next case. You may proceed.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Dave Rohrbach. My co-counsel, Roy Shinnin, and I represent the appellants. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. This appeal concerns the gifting of ownership interest in a family company by a father, the appellee Peter J. Knopf, to his children. Stock certificates reflecting those interests weren't prepared. However, Mr. Knopf conceded that he intended to make the gifts, and the transfers are documented in years of tax returns filed by the company, by Mr. Knopf, and by the children. We make three primary arguments in our briefs, as we did to the trial court below, as to why the gifts from Mr. Knopf to his children are valid and enforceable, all of which we think merit this court's attention. I'd like to focus today, or this afternoon, on assignments of error 1 and 2, which concern primarily the legal and evidentiary effect of the representations made in the tax returns as to the parties' respective ownership interests in the company, Ticonderoga Farms. With respect to assignment of error 1, it's our position that Mr. Knopf is not permitted to take a position in court that's inconsistent with the representations made in the tax returns. When a person makes a representation to the government, whether it's the state government or the federal government, a tax return, that person shouldn't be permitted to come into a Virginia court and take a position contrary to the statement included in the tax returns. In this case, we have nearly 20 years of tax returns reflecting gifts from Mr. Knopf to his children.
Well, counsel, why isn't that between him and the tax people? I mean, if he did something that wasn't proper on his tax returns, why isn't that an issue?
Well, there's authority in many jurisdictions, including the Fourth Circuit, and we cite the In re Rob case, that says that when you file a tax return, you can't come into court. You're essentially stopped from coming into court and taking an inconsistent position, particularly where the taxpayer has obtained a benefit. I don't even know that you need to obtain a benefit. I think it's an affront to the tax system by representing one thing in your tax return and then in a different context, when it suits your purposes, taking a different position. But in this case, to the extent that there was income earned by the company, if Mr. Knopf had a decreased ownership interest in the company, and that's reflected in the tax returns, he's benefited by filing those tax returns with the government because his overall tax liability is decreased.
Without getting into the estoppel question, What is it that you have to prove to prevail? And what's the standard of proof at the trial?
With respect to assignment of error 1?
Well, what I'm looking at is the elements, the intent to transfer, evidence of delivery, and evidence of acceptance. That's your burden.
Correct. That's right. With respect to assignment of error 2. Right. Assignment of error 1 is simply an argument that Mr. Knopf shouldn't be allowed to take a position inconsistent with the tax returns. That,
right,
in our view, is a purely
estoppel argument.
It's a purely legal question that's
right,
subject to de novo review. Assignment of error 2 is that the tax returns should be considered evidence of delivery of the ownership interests. And there are two things that need to be shown to establish an inter vivos gift. Intent really wasn't an issue below, and delivery can be either actual or constructive. The trial court found, as a matter of fact, that Mr. Knopf had authorized the transfers of the interest as reflected in the tax returns, and that Mr. Cummings, who is the accountant, worked at the direction of and with the authority of Mr. Knopf.
No, I don't think that's disputed.
Right, and so I think the court defers to those with respect to your question about the standard of review. This court should refer to the trial court's fact findings. The ultimate conclusion of whether or not the tax returns that Mr. Cummings testified to is enough to establish constructive delivery of those ownership interests is a question of law, subject to de novo review.
So the delivery involves surrender of the power of dominion and control?
Correct.
Okay. All right, so then we get to the only thing that's left, right? Acceptance.
Correct.
Tell us your evidence of acceptance. By the way, this isn't an unfriendly question. I'm just giving you the opportunity to go through through what's required.
Right.
So just, what's the proof of acceptance?
Well, I think there's a presumption under Virginia law and the law of many jurisdictions that a gift is presumed to be accepted because it's something of value. In addition, in this case, you had the children. Let me just take a step back. Mr. Cummings, the accountant, would prepare K-1s reflecting the...
Wouldn't a better argument be that the same accountant did the K-1s for the children?
That
and they relied upon them?
Right. That's where I was going with this, Your Honor. Okay. Is the accountant prepared the K-1s for the corporation, then use those same K-1s to prepare the personal returns for all the shareholders, which included Mr. Knopf and the children.
All right. So then we get to the question of what is the standard of the evidentiary proof necessary at trial? What is that?
The elements of a gift need to be established by clear and convincing evidence.
Okay. So the trial judge said that there was not sufficient evidence by clear and convincing evidence. The way I read this record of acceptance, that's the real issue in the case. Is that correct?
I believe that the trial court found that there wasn't clear and convincing evidence of delivery of the gifts.
Well,
because she found...
As well as acceptance, then. Because if you can't accept something that hadn't been delivered.
Correct.
All right. All right, go ahead.
But again, in this case, you have the tax returns which satisfy, I think, both the delivery and the acceptance.
How do you respond to this thought? One, you make a great argument. Two, it's a factual question. Three, a fact finder decided against you, and you had a really high civil burden of proof, which is clear and convincing. And four, even if all of us would have done something differently if we were a circuit court judge, can we really say that a reasonable jurist could not have reached any other conclusion than the conclusion that you're right?
I think this goes back to my prior point that I believe that the ultimate conclusion as to whether or not the evidence, which in this case is really the tax returns, is sufficient to establish delivery and
well,
acceptance.
It's not a question of sufficiency. It's a question of persuasion. It is sufficient. I'll tell you that right now. Maybe a judge would have ruled for you and found clear and convincing evidence. The question is, this judge didn't. He didn't grant a motion to strike or throw the case out or whatever. He just said, I don't see it.
Right.
So now we're looking at the merits and asking ourselves, would a reasonable jurist be capable, or would it just be plain irrational to look at this fact pattern and walk away saying, I'm not exactly sure if it was really delivered or not. I'm not exactly sure what happened to the K-1s. I'm not exactly sure what the kids were thinking was going on.
Right. Again, I think that the court can review that. I think the court can find that the tax returns are conclusive evidence such that there are no deferences owed to the determination of the trial court.
You're talking about the children's tax returns?
The corporate tax returns.
And what is that conclusive evidence of?
Delivery, right. Of constructive delivery of the ownership interest, and then combined with the children's filing of their personal returns that reflect the same ownership interests is acceptance.
Why is it conclusive evidence isn't an alternative explanation? It was just a lie. So if I tell someone, you know, I'm going to give you $10,000, and they immediately call their account and say, change my tax return because McCullough's going to give me $10,000. And I just flat out lie. Why is that constructive evidence of delivery as opposed to flimflamery?
Well, in this case, you had the accountant testifying that he prepared the K-1s at Mr. Knopf's direction. And the court found that as a fact. She found
right.
That testimony credible.
So there's one plausible interpretation is he really meant to do that, and there's an argument, it's constructive delivery, and the other argument is he said that, but he never intended to do it, he was just lying.
Well, in this case, we have intent. Intent is conceded, that he intended to transfer the ownership interest reflected on those tax returns. But the delivery comes, and you know, even if the standard is plain error instead of de novo review, I would submit that the filing of tax returns, the essence of constructive delivery under the law is, has the donor relinquished dominion and control over the thing that's being gifted? And when you file tax returns or authorize the filing of tax returns with the state and the federal government, representing that those are the interests that you're conveying, what greater or stronger evidence could there be of relinquishment of dominion and control?
Well, we've never said that, though. We've used equitable estoppel and judicial estoppel in a pretty flexible manner. And rarely, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, have we ever said it's indisputably always this way as a matter of law. We've said no, a fact finder can consider these things. And a fact finder here could have considered these things and thought, that's just enough for me to get over clear and convincing evidence. But with respect to the Fourth Circuit opinions on the point, I don't know if there's any Virginia case law allowing a lie to some other governmental entity to stop indisputably a litigant before a court. Am I wrong on that?
I haven't found any authority in this court or in Virginia. It's a pretty widely recognized concept and principle in other jurisdictions, including the Fourth Circuit, and that in Ray Robb case is an example. But that's an example of a litigant being stopped from taking a position that was inconsistent with the representations that litigant had made in tax returns as to whether something should be characterized as alimony or not. And that in the litigant in the tax returns saw a real benefit, a tangible benefit from having taken that position in the tax returns.
Counsel, is there any question? I don't have the record in front of me. Is there any question that the children, I'm calling them like y'all do, when they got the K-1s, they paid their personal income tax based on that?
There's nothing in the record that said that as to what their tax liability was in any given year.
I don't know the number, but did they pay taxes based on the K-1?
Correct. Yes, they did.
That's in the record.
Well, there'd have to be an inference. They filed their tax returns based on the K-1s prepared by Mr. Cummings. Whether they ultimately paid taxes,
they used them for their returns.
Absolutely.
You have evidence of the tax returns. On the other side of the ledger, the evidence is that there were no stock certificates that existed, the corporate records were never updated, and the corporate stock book only contained the stubs for the original issuance of the certificates, the original certificates. So the trial court is looking at those facts and balancing them by clear and convincing evidence. What is your best argument that the tax returns, I'm assuming the father received some reduced payment of taxes based on the fact that it appeared that the stocks had been certificate, had been transferred. What is the best argument that the tax returns trump the other indicia of no delivery?
The test is, for determining deliveries, has the donor relinquished all dominion and control?
Mm-hmm.
And so we would submit that notwithstanding the lack of stock certificates, that's not an issue, that the filing of the tax returns or the authorization of the filing of the tax returns shows a relinquishment of dominion and control. And as a practical matter, filing a tax return provides the same evidence of relinquishment of dominion and control as the manual delivery of a stock certificate. It's proof to the donor, to the donee, and to the world that the gift has been made, which is, if you look at the Virginia case law with respect to the delivery requirement, that's really what the intent is. It's to prevent fraud and perjury. Well, if you're filing tax returns with the government showing that these transfers have been made, that addresses the delivery requirement under Virginia law.
People file tax returns with the government on a fairly regular basis that make statements that aren't borne out.
I agree that putting something in a tax return doesn't make it inherently true. But in this context, what it means is you've in this context, he's relinquished dominion and control over those interests, and he can't now come back and say that what I said before, when it was my to my advantage then.
Well, I can't just amend his tax returns
no longer
and
true.
Say, well, never mind, I really didn't give them the stock. Why wouldn't a simple amendment of the tax return basically erase your entire argument? Not that that was done here.
Right. As a matter of fact, it wasn't done here. But my understanding is you can amend taxes whenever you want, but you can only go back 3 years to get a refund. So if Mr. Knopper had changed the ownership interest reflected in the tax returns, and to the extent that the children have already paid taxes on all of that, they've suffered to their detriment based on the filing of the returns with the higher ownership percentages.
But I thought you were talking about delivery. So what evidence is there that Dad meant to relinquish dominion and control of this stock?
The evidence is the authorization of the filing of the returns. And the act of filing the returns and representing to the government that the information included in the tax returns, that is the relinquishment of the
dominion. So there was no change in his behavior as concerns his control over the company?
No, he was always the majority shareholder, so it didn't have any practical impact on the day-to-day operations of the company.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Michael Dingman and Nicholas Albu for the appellees in this case, Ticonderoga Farms and Peter J. Knopp. The theory that is being presented to this court is a novel theory of inter vivos gift by estoppel. In support of that theory, the appellants, the children, have not cited this court to a single case in Virginia or any other jurisdiction where an inter vivos gift has been established based upon a theory of estoppel. It is also a theory that they never pled in their four complaints in this case, including the operative third amended complaint. What they are asking this court to do, in effect, is to set aside the basic requirements for an inter vivos gift, which the court has already articulated, which is there must be clear and convincing proof of delivery of the gift, acceptance of the gift, and relinquishment by the donor of all dominion and control over that gift.
Why isn't there clear and convincing proof when he says to the Internal Revenue Service, under penalty of perjury, I made these gifts?
Well,
I had the intent to make them. I delivered them. I did everything necessary. The gift was made. And I swear it was made. Why isn't that pretty darn good proof?
First of all, these are corporate tax records. These are not the personal tax records of Peter J. Knopp.
Okay, the company made the gifts. Whatever.
Well, but you need to look at the record as well. Those tax returns, for the most part, were not signed by Peter J. Knopp. And in fact, the preparer of those tax returns, James Cummings, testified that he was the person responsible to determine the accuracy of the information in those returns, not Mr. Knopp. So these are not his personal tax records. And when you look at the In re Rob case, for example, that counsel for appellant referred to, the estoppel was based on the personal tax return of Mr. Rob. And that's the same.
He did this at the direction of Mr. Knopp. Mr. Cummings did. The evidence bears that out.
Well, the evidence, Your Honor, is as follows. Mr. Cummings testified that he was directed from time to time up to the gift tax level to make these adjustments. He also testified, though, that he was never directed by Peter J. Knopp to provide any certificates to the children. He also testified that as we went through the various tax returns, that the percentages were wrong, because based on the valuation, they would have exceeded the gift tax limit, and he testified, Mr. Cummings did, that he had no authority to do that. So the tax returns are not representations by Peter J. Knopf. They're representations by the company. And when you go through those tax returns, the court will see many of them were signed simply by Mr. Cummings as the preparer. All of them were signed by Mr. Cummings as the preparer. Many of those tax returns were signed by Peter R. Cunop, who was the president of Ticonderoga Farms from 1999 to 2006, when the percentage interest went up to what is now being claimed by the children. So these tax returns are not representations by Mr. Knopp. The testimony from Mr. Cummings was they were inaccurate, and there was no evidence, none, presented that there was some tax benefit to Peter J. Knopp, as suggested by counsel for appellant.
Well, counsel, I don't mean to interrupt you, but I have
yes, sir.
Reading from the record, Mr. Knox was asked, did you at any time have a desire to transfer any additional shares to your children? Answer, I intended to do so, yes.
And we've not argued that there was not some donative intent. The issue in the case is, was the gift completed by complying with the requirements for acceptance, delivery, and relinquishment of control?
Well, let me ask you about that. If he intended to transfer additional interest in the company, while he had his corporate tax returns reflected that, the children were issued K-1s, and the children filed their tax returns based on that. Why in the world is he not stopped from the conclusion that he, in fact, successfully gave them more interest?
Well, again, when you look at the record, and it's the burden of the appellants to prove by clear and convincing evidence that he made these representations. If you look at the individual tax returns, you will see that most of them were not signed by Peter J. Knopp. They were prepared by Mr. Cummings. Mr. Cummings testified that he was responsible for the accuracy of those documents. And what they're asking this court to do is to say that with respect to a corporate tax return, if an officer of the company signs that return, with respect to that officer's personal dealings, that person is now bound by the corporate tax return.
The K-1?
I'm sorry, sir.
How do you resolve the fact that the K-1s were issued and the children paid their personal taxes based on those K-1s?
The record does not reflect that the children had any adverse tax implications as a result of their K-1s. In fact, the trial court found, as a matter of fact, that there was no evidence presented by the children regarding the tax consequences and said, we don't know whether they were good or bad. And that's found at page 2042 of the joint appendix.
But they were used in the filing, regardless of what the effect on the personal income tax might have been. Those K-1s, as they're required by law, were used by the children when they filed their tax return.
They were used by the children, but they're issued by the company. And the cases that the appellants have cited to try to support this estoppel theory for a gift, the person or entity being estopped is the person who filed the return. It's either the individual or the company. That is not the case here. And in fact, for many years, Mr. Knopp, as the record shows, was not an officer or director of the company. So the K-1s and the tax returns that were being provided were during a time frame when Peter R. Cunop was the president of the company.
I don't think it's the filing of the corporate return that either Justice Koontz or I am asking about. It is the direction that other people followed to file it that way. So the whole idea that this is a corporate return is interesting. But the question is, does the evidence demonstrate that he directed that the corporate returns be filed this way? I think it's overwhelming that it is. The question is, what does that mean?
Well, and I would suggest just two things in response to that, sir, is that the record shows that Mr. Cummings testified he did not follow the direction given to him by Peter J. Knopp. But secondly, none of this would equate to acceptance, delivery, and relinquishment of control. And this theory, as we argued in our papers, was never pled. There is no estoppel allegation in any of their complaints, including the operative Third Amendment complaint.
They've just mixed two concepts. The one concept is whether or not the evidence necessary to establish an inter vivos gift has been done. That's one question.
Yes, sir.
The other is, irrespective of that, there's an estoppel question, and that may or may not have been an issue in the court below. I'm not quite sure about that. But that's a secondary issue.
Yes, sir. So on the first issue, and this court addressed this specific topic in Young versus Young, what's required for the completion of an inter vivos gift of certificated shares. And the court, relying on the common law and the UCC, said in that instance, the daughters who were claimed to, were the, had received the gift must acquire possession of the certificates, or a third party must acquire possession of the certificates on their behalf. And that was the phrase used, acquire possession of the certificates. Because that did not happen...
Was that case decided before only was removed from the statute? Was that case decided before the word only was removed from
Yes, it was. And I'll come back to that in just a moment.
But we're not dealing with certificates in this case, are we?
Yes, sir.
I thought these were uncertificated interests.
No, sir. The record is undisputable that certificates were issued. A stock book was put into evidence showing the actual certificates, which the trial court found to be accurate. And by the way, some of those certificates show actual gifting of shares by Peter J. Knopp to his children on the stock certificate ledger, which demonstrates he knew how to gift these shares to his children if that's what he wanted to do. So that's undisputed. And the court found that the stock book was accurate. And in fact, the children agreed that their claim of up to 9.08% is based upon their certificates in the stock book. So there was no evidence of uncertificated shares. These were certificated shares. And the evidence is unequivocal that none of those shares were ever delivered to the children or accepted by the children. So the court would have to reverse Young versus Young to find that the requirements for an inter vivos gift have been satisfied. In fact, the court would have to reverse its common law decisions going back more than a century, which require actual delivery of the purported gift.
I'm sorry to interrupt you again, but can I go back to the K-1 issue Justice Kuntz was asking about? The IRC, I don't think, taxes gifts within the annual exclusion, at least look back at the various prior versions of the IRC, as taxable income at all. It's only the amount over the annual exclusion do you get the gift tax, and that factors into the estate gift tax amalgamation. So is there any evidence in this record that the children paid any tax at all based upon the reporting of the gift tax in the K-1?
None. And the purpose of not exceeding the gift tax limit is specifically to avoid tax liability, which is why Mr. Cummings, when he was walked through his tax returns, had to admit that they were wrong because the percentage would have exceeded the $10,000 gift tax limit, and he specifically testified he was never directed or authorized by Mr. Knopp to exceed that gift tax limit for obvious purposes.
Counsel, go back to Young versus Young. Would we have to overrule it if at the time the rule on certificated stock was that the only way to deliver it was to actually hand it over and only was removed, which would seem to indicate there might be other ways?
The court would have to overrule Young versus Young and also the common law, and here's why. In Young versus Young, the court quoted the common law, delivery, acceptance, and relinquishment, and held that that was carried forward in the UCC, specifically with respect to certificated shares, and of course found that because there was no evidence of the certificated shares being delivered or accepted, there was no gift. By simply changing the word, taking the word only out, the legislature did not intend to change the common law, and it did not intend to say that the UCC is no longer mandatory, but simply a suggestion.
Well, there's another argument, which is, we're a plain language court, generally speaking. So when the reading of the statute is plain, you don't get into legislative history and other things. You just stick with plain language. And plain language seems to say this is how you do it.
Yes, it says a delivery occurs when, and it says actual delivery to the donee or delivery to a third party or a securities intermediary.
Well, reading from Young itself, it says, the gift is effective only if the donor has donative intent at the time of the gift and if there is such actual or constructive delivery as divests the donor of all dominion control over the property and invests it in the donee. So actual delivery is not the only way you can do it.
I agree. And we cited to the court constructive delivery cases that were decided under the common law. And every single one of those cases is predicated upon the gift being given to a third party, whether it's the donee, that would be actual. Constructive delivery is you give it to a third party, they put in their safe deposit box, and these are actual examples from the case law, you have now relinquished control of the property. So all of the constructive delivery cases decided by this court are predicated on whatever is the gift actually being turned over to a third party and all control relinquished.
I understand your argument. And you're adding to that the idea that in this case, whatever it is, it's a certificate, and it can be constructively delivered to a third party, or it can be given to the person who is the donee.
Yes, sir, and that's what the UCC says, and that's consistent with the common law. In this deletion of the word only, and we cited to the legislative report, and I agree with Justice McCullough, I think that the statute's clear. It says delivery occurs when one of these three things happen. If one of those three things do not happen, then there cannot be delivery. Otherwise, you would have to look at that statute and determine that it's really not operative. It's just a suggestion. And in looking at the reason for the change, the report of the Joint Subcommittee to the study regarding the modifications to the UCC said, quote, with respect to securities directly held, revised Article 8 retains the basic conceptual structure and rules of present law, which would have included Young versus Young. Two significant categories of security transactions will be relatively unaffected by the revision. Transactions involving securities issued by closed corporations, which is precisely the facts before this court. The revision to the UCC, as that report goes on to state, was to deal with electronic transfer of shares. And so there is no legislative intent to change Young versus Young, and there's certainly no legislative intent to say with respect to certificated shares they are no longer subject to the common law requirements of an inter vivos gift. That would place the UCC in conflict with the common law.
Your time has expired. This session of the Supreme Court is adjourned.